coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Your Excellency, I thought you'd left.
Oh, no, I don't leave.
But I saw you with my own eyes.
Well, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?
Your lying eyes, perception, memory, and justice.
Memory's unreliable.
Oh, please.
No, really. Memory's not perfect. It's not even that good.
Prosecutors rely on eyewitnesses. Too much?
Look, memory can change the shape of a room. It can change the color of a car. And memories can be distorted. They're just an interpretation. They're not a record. You can't hide
your lying eyes. Let's be clear. Nobody is saying we should just stop relying on eyewitness testimony.
Our guest is Daniel Riesberg, author of The Science of Perception and Memory, a pragmatic guide for the justice system.
But what is, I think, amazing is just how little it takes to pull memory off track. There ain't no way to hide
your lying eyes. Your lying eyes. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hi, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being a partner in Philosophy Talk. Now, you've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that. But we need your help now more than ever. We need your help to make more of what we know that you love.
So here's how you do it. You go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the I Will Help button. It will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the campus of Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
40 wonderful years, John. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, we're calling this episode Your Lying Eyes, Perception, Memory, and Justice.
Eyewitness testimony is crucial. It can make or break a criminal trial.
Yeah, but John, the question is, can eyewitness testimony really be trusted?
What were we talking about? Oh, when you're old like me, your eyes do start to deceive you, and memory can turn into a pretty fickle friend.
Yeah, but it's not just the effects of aging that I'm thinking about. Psychological research, John, reveals a lot of really deeply troubling facts about human perception and human memory. They're kind of independent of age, but they're enough to make me wonder, at least, if we can ever rely on eyewitness testimony.
Ah, Ken, you're being an alarmist as usual. You got to have faith in America's genius, our adversarial system of justice. Effective cross-examination works wonders for ferreting out the truth. Don't you watch Perry Mason reruns?
John, I actually think that the adversarial system makes things worse, not better. Think about the number of people wrongly convicted on the basis of supposedly reliable eyewitness testimony. You know, about 73% of all convictions overturned through DNA evidence were originally based on eyewitness testimony. Now ask yourself, why do we have all those wrongful convictions if our system is such a genius?
One wrongful conviction is one too many. We can all agree on that. But you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Most eyewitnesses probably get it mostly right most of the time.
Gee, that's not exactly a ringing endorsement for the reliability of eyewitness testimony, John.
Well, what's the alternative? Ouija boards? I mean, with proper safeguards, we have no choice and no reason not to trust eyewitness testimony. We can surely rely on the perception and memory for normal people in everyday life most of the time.
Yeah, but that's a lot more at stake in the courtroom than in everyday life. Let's put it to the test here, John. I want you to suppose you were a witness to a serious crime, maybe a bank robbery. Let's assume you saw it up close and personal. Maybe you came face to face with the robber.
Well, thank you. I just as soon not have that experience.
Yeah, okay, I know that. But the question is, do you think you'd be a good witness?
Well, old age aside, I'm a pretty observant fellow.
Yeah, you are pretty observant.
I recognize you almost every time we
meet. Yes, John, you're observant. I admit that. But you got to admit, you'd find it a pretty stressful and emotional situation, wouldn't you?
Well, of course I would. A guy has a gun in my face and robbing me, yes, probably I would be a little bit stressed.
You know, well, here's the point, though. Scientists have shown that stress and emotion have pretty severe effects on our ability to recall things accurately. Do you think you'd be immune from the effects of emotional stress on memory in that situation?
Well, no, probably not. But I think if I came to face with a guy holding a gun and robbing a bank I was in, that face would be etched on my memory for a long time.
You think so. There's something called the weapon effect. Did you know that when people witness a crime involving a weapon, they actually tend to focus on the weapon and not at all on the face?
Well, maybe at first that's sort of natural, but I'm sure I would start to mentally note his physical features, height, weight, general facial features, ethnicity, tattoos, scars. You know, I mean, I watch TV. I know how it's done.
John, do you know how many people think they got a good look at a face in a stressful situation like that when they really didn't? Do you know how often our supposed memories of things like faces actually just sort of made up?
Oh, come on, Ken. You mean witnesses in criminal cases really just set out to make up lies?
No, I'm not saying they do it on purpose. People aren't deliberately lying about what they think they saw. But far too often, their memories, and especially their confidence in their memories, "I'm sure I saw that guy in the..." are inadvertently enhanced by poorly trained, overzealous police officers and prosecutors eager for a conviction and less concerned about truth, John.
And now you're dumping on the police and the prosecutors, just like everybody. Do you think they really don't want to get it right? Do you think they want to get false convictions?
That's not what I'm saying. But if they aren't adequately sensitized to the pitfalls of eyewitness testimony, they could end up, despite their best intention, unwittingly leading witnesses into being much more certain of what they actually saw than they deserve to be. They can even cause them to be convinced that they saw things that the objective facts prove they couldn't have seen, that they never saw, John.
You're painting a pretty bleak picture, Ken.
That's just the start of it. The worst thing about is that we haven't even begun to grapple with the social cost of a criminal justice system that relies far too much on far too unreliable eyewitness testimony, John. It's a mess.
Well, there you have a point. And to help us start thinking about those costs, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to speak with a man who spent years in prison because of a false eyewitness identification. She files this report.
In 1994, in the town of Waukegan, Illinois, a young white woman was kidnapped from her apartment by two Latino men. She was forced into a car, taken to a backyard, and then raped. Angel Gonzalez happened to be nearby.
By coincidence, I was visiting my ex-girlfriend's sister's house. She lives in the same apartment right across from the apartment where the victim lives.
Besides being a young Latino man, Gonzalez didn't match the description of the attackers. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Cops pulled him over that night with guns drawn. The victim was taken to Gonzalez's car to identify him. She ID'd him as the attacker from a distance, from the back of a patrol car, with headlights shining on Gonzalez. He spent the night in jail and signed a confession the next day, in English, even though he couldn't speak or read a word of it. He had just moved here from Mexico. Gonzalez spent the next 20 years behind bars.
The prison was pretty much run by the inmates on the inside, so there was a lot of crazy things that going on a daily basis.
After learning English and getting a high school degree in prison, Gonzalez was released on March 10, 2015. DNA evidence proved he was innocent all along. Gonzalez is not alone. Eyewitness misidentification played a role in almost three-quarters of the convictions overturned through DNA testing. It's the single greatest cause of wrongful convictions in the U.S. What happened to Gonzalez is called a show-up. The victim shows up to where a suspect was found and IDs him on the spot.
Show-ups are actually very, very troublesome. We know that show-ups occurred with some frequency in the DNA exoneration cases.
That's Karen Neuwirth. She's a lawyer with the Innocence Project, a group that helps wrongfully convicted people get out of prison.
When individuals are presented in a show-up, there's a lot of very suggestive context, right? They may be handcuffed. They may be standing in front of a marked police car under bright lights. All of this cues the witness to believe that this is a bad person who did the crime.
One of Neuwirth's jobs is to explain to lawyers and judges that the human mind is not a tape recorder. Memory can be influenced and altered by many things.
The lighting conditions, the distance, if the witness and the perpetrator were of different races, if a weapon was present. So all of these things will affect the strength of the initial memory.
Neuwirth says one solution is to change police procedures to make them more consistent with the social science research on memory.
Using instructions to the witness that say, this may or may not be the perpetrator, don't feel compelled to make an identification, the investigation will continue whether or not you make an identification. And those instructions are designed to counter the witness's natural assumption that because they're being shown someone, that person must have done it.
Techniques like this may have kept Angel Gonzalez out of prison. Instead, he lost 20 years of his life. But Gonzalez says he now has a new appreciation for life itself.
For example, I was looking at a tree one day and a few people stop and look at the tree and they asked me what kind of animal I was looking at. Like, and I'm not looking at an animal, I'm looking at the branches of the tree. So just the smallest things now, they bring me happiness.
Today, Angel Gonzalez lives alone in Chicago. He makes a living doing tune-ups on his friends' cars. Reintegration into society has been hard. He wants to go back to school and learn more about the technologies he's missed the past two decades, like how to use a computer. But most importantly, Gonzalez wants to help groups like the Innocence Project so that innocent people like him don't spend time behind prison walls. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that very interesting and somewhat depressing piece. I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the beautiful chapel at Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Our guest today is the Patricia and Clifford Lunenburg Professor of Psychology here at Reed. He's author of this very fine book here, The Science of Perception and Memory, A Pragmatic Guide for the Justice System. Now, please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Daniel Riesberg.
Dan, as a research psychologist, you do a lot of work within the justice system. Research, labs, justice system, not labs. How did a research psychologist get involved in the justice system?
Ironically, I never intended to work in this domain at all. I was pulled into it by a variety of forces, including the fact that early on I would get phone calls just out of the blue from attorneys who would say, I hear you work on memory. I got a case that involves memory. Maybe you can help me. And we would go from there. And that's more or less how it got going. And it's just been a growing involvement for me across the last 20, 25 years.
So common sense tells us that human beings are fallible. We don't always see what's right in front of us. We don't always remember correctly. But your research tells us that that's just kind of, you know, the surface, that under various situations, things really get a lot worse. What's the most surprising thing the science of perception and memory has shown you about human fallibility?
Most surprising. Well, I mean, it's clear to us all, as you said earlier, John, witnesses usually get it right. And it's clear, as you said, Ken, that witnesses don't always get it right. But what is, I think, amazing to me is just how little it takes to pull memory off track and how far off track memory can go in many circumstances.
That's something that struck me reading your book, these examples of people getting far off track with just a little bit of prodding. Give us some examples.
Well, I mean, the classic examples are cases in which witnesses were asked questions that just had one or two leading words built into the question. The difference between did you see a gun versus did you see the gun? I mean, that one word substitution from a gun to the gun dramatically changes how somebody's going to report the event and also how they're going to remember it down the road. With a little bit more, with just a couple of interviews, you can go much further And in many studies, we've been able to plant memories of entire episodes that never took place at all.
That's the thing that struck me. How can you do that? You can make people seem to remember something that just never happened.
The way it works usually is you have to interview them perhaps twice, maybe even three times. You give them reason to believe that you know what you're talking about. You tell them, I talked to your parents, I talked to your little brother, and you describe for them an episode out of their childhood, something that may have happened 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And the first time you describe it to them, they say, nah, that doesn't sound familiar at all, and they just scoff at it. And when you come back the second or the third time, they gradually say, yeah, maybe that does sound a little familiar. And by the third conversation, they're fully endorsing it, they're remembering it in detail, they're filling out the details of this non-existent episode. It doesn't take much.
These are techniques that you and your other diabolical scientists have perfected in your laboratories. That's an evil laboratory, deep under psychology buildings. You're not suggesting that our trusted local policemen and prosecutors have actually stumbled on these same techniques, are you?
I am certainly suggesting it.
Okay. Wow.
And look, I mean, in the psychological studies, I mean, we deliberately try to plant memories because we're trying to figure out where the limits are, but it doesn't take somebody deliberately trying to plant these memories, and lots of circumstances in real-world cases, in real cases in the justice system, the police inadvertently suggest an idea, or perhaps a therapist suggests an idea. It can come from lots of different sources.
That the gun versus a gun. The cops know that there was a gun. They don't know that you saw the gun. But if they say, did you see the gun? They've just planted the suggestion in your mind. It doesn't have to be on purpose.
That's right.
But anyway, this is Philosophy Talk. Coming to you from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, our guest is Daniel Riesberg, author of The Science of Perception and Memory.
What role should psychological science play in the criminal justice system? Can it tell us about the reliability of specific eyewitnesses, for example?
Eyewitness testimony, the science of perception, and the criminal justice system, along with questions from what I hope is our non-criminal audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, Dialectic, a group of students here at Reed College. What a great name for their group, the Dialectic, very philosophical. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Daniel Riesberg from Reed College. And we're thinking about your lying eyes, perception, memory, and criminal justice.
How reliable do you think you'd be if you witnessed a crime? How confident would you be in identifying the criminal? Would you question what you think you saw or remembered? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone right here in front of the stage and making up some eyewitness testimony for us to poke holes in.
So Dan, as I read your book, it's kind of a textbook, but it's not aimed at students at your college here. It's aimed at people like prosecutors and police officers.
That's right.
And so look, pretend I'm one of those kind of people. What do you want me to know about how to handle eyewitness testimony in my day-to-day business?
Well, what I don't want you to know is that you should never trust eyewitnesses, or they should always trust eyewitnesses. I mean, what you can do in your case, or any attorney can do in any case, is look at the case facts and basically sort through looking for factors that are part of the evidence that we know can, in some cases, increase the chances of a memory mistake, or in some cases can decrease the chances of a memory mistake. And then once you know what kinds of influences are on the scene, basically it tells you what the danger level is that somebody's likely to make a mistake.
So I've got a client, I've got a witness, I'm a prosecutor, let's pretend. I've got a witness who swears up and down that she saw Jones over there with that gun in that store at that time. She swears up and down. Okay, what should I worry about?
Okay, well, the first thing I would certainly want to know is whether what you're describing is how confident that witness is now, perhaps days or weeks or maybe even months after the crime, as opposed to how confident the witness was at the time of the crime when the police first showed this person a lineup or a show up.
So what would be good, if she's less confident now than she was then, or if she's more confident now than she was then?
Well, the fast answer is that the level of confidence now is, according to lots of studies, essentially worthless as an indicator of whether the witness is right or wrong. What you really want to know is what the level of confidence was at the very first moment that the person made that identification. It's not a perfect indicator of whether the person's right or wrong, but it's a decent indicator in contrast to their confidence now, which is just has no value at all.
So I hope your book is a success as a textbook. I hope prosecutors and police buy it and read it and study it and pass exams on it. But let's go back to this example from our roving philosophical reporter. Now, I'm a cop. A young lady's been raped. She's the victim. I've got a guy over here in a car. I drive her up in another car. She looks through the windows and so forth and so on, identifies him. Now, I haven't read your book. I mean, of course I have, but I mean, I'm pretending I haven't read your book. I think anybody with any common sense about the way humans work would think, you know, that's kind of shaky. So is the real problem that they don't know these things or that they don't want to apply common sense to the situations they're in?
Well, let me start by saying that, I mean, one of the reasons why these cases are so troubling is that the errors are always double errors. Because what happened in that case is that we sent somebody innocent to jail, which is tragic, but we also allowed the real rapists, the real perpetrators, to walk free, which is also tragic. So you've got a double error there, making those cases very troubling. But the bottom line is that, in truth, witnesses tend to believe, sorry, jurors tend to believe witnesses, police officers tend to believe witnesses, and there's something very compelling when somebody's sitting in the witness stand and says, that's the man I saw that night, or that's the woman who was in the bank. That's really powerful stuff in the courtroom. It's high drama.
Witnesses, okay, juries believe witnesses, police officers believe witnesses, prosecutors believe witnesses. Witnesses believe themselves, right?
Quite right.
Now, I mean, I bet you if I ask anybody in the audience to remember some event in their lives, they would be pretty confident of that. Okay, I think you're barking up a pretty steep hill. Or that's a terrible metaphor.
Yeah, right.
You got a big boulder to roll up that hill to convince people that what they think they remember, they really don't remember. I mean, convince me that my memory is not in. I rely on my memory every day in my life. And I know my mother's getting old. She's, you know, and so I know memory fades, but I'm not at that stage yet. I mean, I think people think their mind is like a recording device. I think they think their eyes are like a camera.
You're certainly right. People do tend to trust their memories. They probably overtrust their memories. But one of the reasons why, for example, these DNA exonerations are so important is if you're looking for demonstrations of how witness identifications can go off track, those are really powerful cases. In many of those cases, there were multiple eyewitnesses, and they all were saying, that's the guy who robbed me, who attacked me, who raped me, and they all had it wrong.
Okay, but so what is the kind of nugget of why perception and memory are not like a camera and a recording device, respectively? What would the thing you would say to teach us a better way of thinking about what perception and memory are like?
Our memories are wonderful at doing a somewhat different job than the law enforcement community is asking them to do. What the law enforcement community wants us to do is to remember a single episode without biasing that memory or shaping that memory with any other sort of knowledge. In contrast, what our memories are really good at is picking up a piece of information here, picking up a piece of information there, and weaving them together, which gives us a much richer, much more powerful pattern of knowledge, but helps us to lose track of where we got the knowledge from, and that's where a lot of the memory errors come
from. So I was explaining what the show's about to my wife, and I said, partly it's because memory is constructed. Memory isn't just impress on you. There's a complicated cognitive process of constructing your memory that involves schemas and all this stuff. Does that seem plausible?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, so, I mean, look, I mean, if I learn something about you today, Ken, and I learn something about you 3 days from now and a month from now, I want to put those pieces of information together so I'm constructing a rich, sophisticated, cross-referenced pattern of knowledge. And for many purposes, it doesn't matter whether I learned a particular information about you today or a week from now. I just want the full package. That's what memory is really good at, but that's just different from what law enforcement needs.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about your lying eyes, perception, memory, and justice in front of a live audience at Reed College. And we've got a question from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm from Portland. I have two quick questions. One, is there anything I can do in my everyday life to become a better eyewitness? And two, has anyone in the justice system reached out to you to learn ways to interview for more accurate eyewitness?
Let's take these one at a time. First, if you want to be a better eyewitness, do not follow John's advice. John's comment earlier was, Ken asked him, imagine you were in a bank robbery, and John said, I'm going to examine the features. I'm going to look at the eyes. I'm going to look at the nose. That turns out to be a really terrible way to memorize a face. What you want to do instead is sort of take a step back and look at the whole pattern and try to make judgments about the whole face. So you do silly things like asking, does this person seem intelligent? Does this person seem honest? Those kinds of questions seem like they're going in the wrong direction, but they force you into looking at the whole configuration of the face, and that actually gives you a better face memory. So there are strategies that you can use in the moment that will help you to be a better memorizer of faces. And then for your other question, yes, I mean, the criminal justice system across the country, and certainly here in Oregon, has been slowly moving forward and embracing the science, reaching out not just to me, but to the entire research community. There's a report from the National Academy of Sciences not so many months back, helping to move it forward. So on the topic of eyewitness memory, eyewitness identification, law enforcement in the U.S. is slowly getting better, but certainly getting better.
You said law enforcement. I was about to say something. Maybe what I'm about to say, you just refute it. I was about to say, I bet you defense attorneys love your services. I bet you defense attorneys love you to come up and impeach the memory of the prosecution witnesses.
Well, the reality is, often they do, but often they do not. I mean, it's routinely the case that defense attorneys will bring me a case, and I look at it and say, gee, I see no reason here to challenge the witnesses. I'd be a really good witness for the prosecution. And at that point, the defense attorney says, thank you very much. I'll see you in the next one. Click, and that's
okay,
the end of the conversation.
Okay. But did the prosecution ever pick up the phone and call you?
Ironically and sadly, no.
Okay. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment? Who are you and where are you from and what's your comment?
Hi, my name's Steve. I'm from Portland as well. So if I was on trial for a crime and there was eyewitness testimony, I think I would like my defense team now to rely on this scientific research to undermine the credibility of eyewitness testimony altogether. And so I guess what my question is that if we do start accepting this research, what exactly happens to criminal justice procedure in America?
Okay.
That's a darn good question. Thank you for the question.
Let's be clear. Nobody is saying we should just stop relying on eyewitness testimony.
I said that, but I don't count.
Nobody says it and means it. it's clear we need eyewitness testimony, and let's also make sure we keep our eyes on the fact that eyewitnesses do get it right most of the time. And therefore, if you're on trial, heaven forbid, and your defense attorneys call me, I may or may not be able to help, because it is often the case that you look at the case facts and you say, the eyewitnesses got a good view, they were paying attention, the police procedures were done properly. And in those kinds of cases, there's every reason to trust the eyewitnesses, in which case the science can be genuinely helpful for the prosecution.
So wait a minute, you say eyewitnesses get it right most of the time. Why do they get it right most of the time? Because they're not in the kind of situations that stress memory and perception? Do they get it right most of the time when they're in those kind of circumstances where the lighting is bad, it's emotionally fraught, it happens quickly? Okay, yeah. Did you see him come in the door? Yeah. Were the lights on? Yeah. Okay, that's a cheap way of getting it right. Do they get it right in the fraught kind of circumstances?
Yes, they often do. And the key thing here is that when eyewitnesses make mistakes, the mistakes aren't random. I mean, the mistakes are encouraged by a list of identifiable factors. Some of the factors are, I think, totally unsurprising. Like, for example, if it's really dark, it's hard to see things. I mean, I'm sure everyone in the room is startled to hear that. But other things are more surprising. The Karen Neuwirth quote we heard earlier suggesting that it's really important to offer the right instructions prior to a lineup. That's important. It's really important, as we discussed earlier, to collect somebody's degree of certainty immediately and stick with that level of certainty. So there's a whole bunch of things you can systematically do, both in a proactive way so that you can get better evidence from the start. That's clearly where we want to be. But also things that you can look at after the fact as a way of sorting through. This is a case in which the eyewitness testimony really does look trustworthy, and this is a case in which eyewitness testimony looks shaky.
John, you want to get
it? Yeah, in our introduction, I said optimistically that, well, the adversarial system will catch these eyewitness mistakes. But, of course, I don't know that there's any truth in that. I mean, is the adversarial system, that is where the defense attorney and the prosecutor are just, you know, each taking one side of it and trying to prove it, as opposed to some systems they have in other countries where the judge is kind of trying to put together the evidence and everybody's supposed to be helping him. Is the adversarial system a good way of getting at faulty eyewitness testimony or a bad way?
Look, there's pluses and minuses to the adversarial system. That would be a long conversation for another day. But as to whether the adversarial system helps us with eyewitness errors, all of the science says it does not. If a witness has just made an honest mistake, I mean, the witness is not lying. The witness is just confused, is mistaken. They're going to stay mistaken throughout testimony, no matter how the cross-examination unfolds.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
I'm Karen. I was born right here in Portland.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much our beliefs affect memory and testimony and our lying eyes. And that kind of in the sense of, is there an intersection with cognitive distortion or cognitive dissonance?
Well, we've been talking primarily about memory, but let's shift the focus a little bit and talk about, I mean, what you perceive in the first place. And it's certainly the case that if you go into a situation with very strong expectations, that can fairly powerfully color what you see. I mean, it's not going to cause you to hallucinate, but if you're in a typical crime, typical crimes are fast-paced. Ken has a couple of times reminded us that you're likely to be under high stress. You're often going to be focused on the gun and not focused on other things. So you're getting diminished input because you don't have time to look at everything. You don't have the attention to look at everything. And under those circumstances, you're going to fill in a lot with what you believe in the first place. So in that way, expectations can literally change what you perceive.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about perception, memory, and justice with Daniel Riesberg, author of The Science of Perception and Memory.
How should courts treat eyewitness testimony? What kind of advice should judges give the jury? And how can we make the system more just for everyone?
We're coming to you from Reed College in Portland, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our live and non-criminal audience, but highly perceptive with perfect memories when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guest, The Dialectic, all students here at Reed College. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Daniel Riesberg from Reed College, and we're thinking about your lying eyes, perception, memory, and justice. We've got questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk now.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Bridget, and I'm from Palmer, Alaska. My question has to do with technology and how our constant use of our iPhones and everything, if over the years that you've been studying people's memory, if you're starting to see people's capability for remembering certain things improving or diminishing. For example, I know most of us can no longer remember strings of numbers, phone numbers. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to the issue that technology has in that regard, and then also maybe just as far as eyewitnesses go, most of us are always watching or looking at our iPhone when we're in public places and are just less observant. So just sort of if you could talk about that.
Sure. I don't know of any reason to think that the technology is making our memories worse. Certainly the technology is changing our memories for a very simple reason. What we remember is very powerfully shaped by what we pay attention to. And I don't pay attention to phone numbers anymore because my phone does a perfectly good job of keeping track of them for me. And so I have ceased paying attention to them. I don't know my son's phone numbers. Sorry to my sons.
But let's
I pay attention to other stuff, and therefore I remember the other stuff.
Let's take that question in another direction. You know, these recent string of police civilian exchanges, let's be neutral, that have been caught on iPhones and gone viral on social media. I mean, I think they do show us something about the world is different from the world that's sometimes presented to us, say, through police testimony. Mm-hmm. I mean, this technology at least shows us that the courtroom, that what has been going on in courtrooms and police interrogations, it's not always and only a accurate reflection of reality. So it shows us we have a lot of work to do to get truth out, doesn't it?
Sure. Two-part answer. First, it's certainly true that the recordings coming off of people's phones, the recordings coming off of these chest cameras that many police officers are now wearing, those recordings are just reminding us again and again that memory is often off track and that the objective recording from these gadgets is telling us that the humans are less reliable than we might have thought. That's just perfectly clear. The other part of the answer is that it's a whole new world with people wearing chest cameras, cops wearing chest cameras, and it simply remains to be seen what this is going to do to the justice system. One of the difficulties is that we may be dealing with too much information. A police officer has hours and hours of video recorded during a week, but stay tuned. It's a whole new world.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My name is Irish. I'm a Reed student originally from Connecticut. We're hearing a lot about some techniques that can be used to enhance the reliability of eyewitness testimony in a perfect world where law enforcement listens to exactly what you have to say. How would you make them gather eyewitness testimony?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We were going to ask that question, but we let her ask it instead. We planted her in the audience. Excellent question.
Well, let me start by saying that if it were that wonderful, perfect world in which I could govern police procedure fully, boy, there's an intimidating prospect.
We have the power right now to make you czar of the world for 15 minutes.
The kind of science we're talking about in this hour is going to solve some of the problems in the justice system, but let's be clear that it's not going to solve all of the problems.
Well,
in
it's
the
not
going to
solve our over-incarceration
problem.
Exactly
right.
The prison industrial complex. We put more people in jail for more things for longer than any place in the world.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the United States has at this point coming up on about 2.5 million people behind bars, many of them for nonviolent offenses.
A quarter of all the people behind bars in the world are behind bars in the United States.
Many of them are mentally ill, they're not receiving appropriate treatment, and of course there is an outrageous racial disparity.
Okay, so you're not going to fix that.
So, I mean, those problems are huge and cannot be pushed to the side, but, I mean, if we can improve the things that we can improve, certainly the move toward improving identification procedures, let's get rid of the show-up altogether, in which the police show just one person to the witness and say, yes or no, is this the person? Let's get rid of that. Let's replace it with lineups. And in order to do it quickly and efficiently, let's rely on the technology that is already there in pretty much every police car. Police cars routinely have a laptop in them already. That's a step we can obviously take. There's better instructions that we can give prior to a lineup. That's going to be important. Recording of exactly how the identification procedure is conducted, that's going to be important. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound cynical, but I will. I can see why defense attorneys want to do this. I can see that if the prosecutors were dedicated to the truth above all, they too would want to do this. But I just don't believe that that's what our system is like. I don't want to cast aspersions on all prosecutors, but I believe they trust their guts. They trust their police officers. They trust the gut judgment of their police officers. And they work with these folks every day. And so they're just not prepared to be told that they've been doing this all wrong. I bet you there's some judge or prosecutor who said to you, I don't need you. I've been doing this all my life. I know how to judge the good from the bad.
Yeah, but in America, we have the federal system, we have the 50 states, and we have lots of systems within the states. It's probably hard to generalize.
Yeah, I mean, John has this exactly right. I mean, we talk about the justice system as though it's one thing, but there are lots of different justice systems with different police stations, different courthouses, different judges within the same courthouse, all following their own individualized pattern. And yes, there is a culture in place that is in many ways resistant to the science, but gee, I thought you were going to make me czar of the world, so I'm going to change the culture as well.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm from Portland. I had a very humbling experience as a Reed student about 25 years ago where I was a volunteer in a thesis student's project research with Dr. Riesberg about eyewitness testimony. Very humbling because I completely flunked and I was very surprised at it. And since then, I have become a physician where one of my roles is to be a really good observer. So really my question on that is there a time of life where people are better witnesses? Children, teenagers, young adults? Adults, are there professions that make you more reliable eyewitness? Like, are there characteristic of witnesses that make them more reliable or not?
Two-part answer. First of all, you mentioned that you're a physician, so let's be clear that the issues of memory we're talking about today are not just relevant to the justice system. I mean, when a physician takes a history from a patient, when did this start hurting? Has it been better or worse? Does it get worse on rainy days? Those are all memory-based questions, and therefore anything we can do to improve the process of collecting memories has multiple benefits. And I'm afraid I've now lost track of what your other question was.
Oh. Are there characteristics of witnesses in terms of time of life, like
time
children,
life,
teenagers,
yeah.
adults,
yeah.
or
yes.
Professions that would lead to them being more reliable?
Here's the ironic answer. For many years, the research that was done primarily with what you call a convenience population, which basically means we were studying college freshmen and sophomores. turns out their memories are systematically better than people who are younger and then older than that. And so when we were claiming, oh my God, memory is sometimes fallible, we were actually making things look better than they actually were because we were studying the people who were best able to remember.
This is one of the pitfalls of social science research in university campuses. This is, you know, either they have a nursery and they study little kids or they study college sophomores. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
My name is Leilani. I'm a student here at Reed, and I was thinking about in criminal cases like the Central Park Five and Joyce McKinney and the Man Called Mormon, we see how media sensationalism affects the judgments and prejudices of our juries. So I'm wondering if you could speak to how or if at all media coverage affects our testimonies.
One of the deeply worrisome issues is the conflict between the constitutional protection of a free press and the constitutional protection of a right to an impartial jury in ways that your question anticipates. Those are often in conflict with each other, and the courts, to a large extent, have no decent remedy for the problem. Often, you can screen people in the community who never go anywhere near the media. That by itself can give you a pretty strange jury.
Let me ask you about juries. So we talk about a textbook addressed to prosecutors, police, defense attorneys. What about the jurors? They're the ones, ultimately, who have to be able to decide whether the testimony is reliable or not. And they're kind of free to do whatever they want by the law. They're the ultimate trier of fact. I mean, well, if you could have a seminar for potential jurors, what are the two or three takeaways you'd want to communicate to them?
One of the foci for current research is to see if we can improve instructions to juries with exactly this aim. One of the difficulties, though, is that the population of jurors is a mixed bag. I mean, for example, I strongly suspect that listeners of Philosophy Talk would routinely be tossed out of the jury pool.
So I'm going to give you a chance to make one closing thought. If you want to, leave us with one thought about this research and the impact of this research and what we should do about it, what's your one closing thought?
I think the one thought may be an encouraging thought, which is that very slowly, with some amount of resistance, the justice system is starting to take the science seriously, both in the police stations and in the courthouses. The progress is not even, the progress is not fast, but I do think we are moving forward.
So on that optimistic note, I mean, gee, you're making me feel like an optimist. I'm not usually that. Dan, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Daniel Riesberg. He's a professor of psychology here at Reed College. He's author of The Science of Perception and Memory, A Pragmatic Guide for the Justice System. So, John, what are your thoughts now?
Well, my main thought is about this band, the Dialectic. They're so terrific, and it brings me back to my childhood, which was all Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman and these songs they've been playing. I don't know about the Dialectic, though. Are they naming themselves after Hegel? Why can't they call themselves Impressions and Ideas and name themselves after Hume? So that's my thought.
That's your main thought. My main thought, well, I did love the Dialectic, but my main thought is, I think our criminal justice system, I think it really needs to be thought root and branch. I mean, we talked about the eyewitness testimony. We alluded to the over-incarceration. This thing is a mess. It's a mess in many domains, and I think it's one of the great social issues of our time.
Yeah, but,
to
but
fix it.
Think if we didn't have those guarantees against cruel and unusual punishment and excessive bail, think how bad things would be. That's a joke.
Yeah. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner on our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now we're going to hear from someone too fast to trust even his own eyes. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it's no big secret that eyewitness testimony is not that reliable, but the mind's eye is easily misled as well. Take Pope Francis. His recent visit to the U.S. was hailed by progressives because he was seen as a much more open and friendly guy than the last few popes. But then, on his way out of town, he met with that clerk in Kentucky who refused to give marriage licenses to gay couples. Suddenly, secular humanists felt betrayed. The Pope let the atheists down. They forgot for a minute that he's not your liberated Uncle Frank, the mayor of Niceville. He's the Pope. They do not come any more Catholic. They just don't. Then there are the right-wing views of Planned Parenthood, where rabid zombie fetuses run wild, paid for by our tax dollars. Well, it's mainly a place for women to get screened for cancer, but it does not seem to have dissipated hatred one whit. Conservatives see themselves as muscular warriors doing battle in a vast culture war. That's what Ted Cruz sees in a mirror, I believe. Progressives, on the other hand, see themselves as weary warriors. They want to lie down, but there's just too much work to be done. They'll stay up all night if they have to, drafting that concerned email to the nation. None of these self-images have much to do with reality. We also have that relatively new term, optics. If you're a chat show expert, you use this term on a regular basis, along with metrics, disruption, pushback, and privatize. Optics is the newfangled way of asking, what would the neighbors think, only on a global scale? Not is it right or wrong, but how does it look? We all have our own beer goggles or blinkers or 2D glasses in a 3D world. The sister of a friend of mine's roommate, a hairstylist in another state, went to the police to get a restraining order against a former boyfriend. They kind of laughed at her. They save restraining orders for abusive husbands and family members, apparently. And their optics on the situation told them that she was some kind of bitter ex trying to make trouble for a decent young fellow. So she got zipped from law enforcement, and a week or so later, he came over to her house and shot her. Well, she's okay, but boy, were those cops' faces red. You get the point. We believe what's stuck in our head until it's pushed out and something else gets pushed in. And for every push, there's also a pushback. Black lives matter is one optic. What about white lives is the whiny pushback. And now everybody has guns, which is great or terrible, depending on your optics. A few years back, I was on a jury. The defendant, a young black man, was charged with attempted murder, attempted manslaughter, and assault with a deadly weapon. The prosecutor was trying to portray him as a sinister figure and a hothead. As part of this effort, the prosecutor referred several times, offhandedly, to the defendant's dogs, who were contained in back of his house in a secure enclosure. I imagine drooling mastiffs and pit bulls with glowing sulfurous eyes like the Hound of the Baskervilles, separated from us by electrified barbed wire as they lurked together in their concrete bunker doghouses. Well, in the final days of the trial, the police footage was shown as cops proceeded cautiously through the crime scene and then through the backyard, with the cameras in their helmets revealing, in washed-out, shaky surveillance camera footage, the chained-up dogs. They were pugs. Little pugs came waddling up to an ordinary chain-link fence looking for a treat or a pet, their tongues lolling, their little butts wiggling. So sometimes, yes, eyes can lie. On the other hand, thank goodness, I can still tell a lap dog from a slavering beast, a hawk from a handsaw, and a pope from a beer in the woods. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Kevin Myers, Brittany Corrigan McElroy, and our Reed College musicians, Hade Shoup on bass, James Sisler on drums, Sam Ramirez on piano, and Makoto Kelp on trombone.
Thanks also to Joel Groves, Zach DeHart, Jim Stanek, and our philosophers of time, Megan and Rick.
And a special thank you to our hosts, the Reed College Office of the Dean of the Faculty in Public Affairs.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research, and our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.